Before we begin today, why don't we take a think about some of our favourite libertarian heroes? Ludwig von Mises, Milton Friedman, Harun al-Rashid, Genghis Khan, Suleiman the Magnificent. Now, those first two may have been familiar to you, but what are we doing with these warmongers among our libertarian friends? Well, the reason I want to bring these figures up is because the relationship between empire and free trade is not often thought about as being interlinked. The Mongol Empire, the Abbasid Caliphate, and the Ottoman Empire all operated varying degrees of free trade. In fact, the whole doctrine of establishing a vast trade network often has required in history one power to have a monopoly of violence to create a kind of free area for the traders to move in, which is one of the mechanisms as to how it comes about. But more importantly, free trade, that is pulling people into your economic zone, is actually a power mechanism. It's a tool of control. And I'm going to be talking about this theory of empire, formal and informal, as we discuss the main topic today, which is why I think the tariffs or the tariff strategy that Trump is boldly adopting at the moment represents the American empire in its downward swing. Okay. First of all, let's have a look at the British Empire. And I'm going to spend most of this lecture today looking at the British Empire. So if you have a look, just coming out of the Napoleonic period, the British Empire had very large tariffs. This was classic mercantilism. So the early British Empire was mercantilist in nature, high protective tariffs, trying to secure monopoly trading rights with various colonies and keeping out rivals such as the French. But as their power expanded over the 19th century, they adopted a policy famously of laissez-faire, classical liberal low tariffs or free trade. Now, obviously, it was never quite zero, as you can see, but the fact is they came down from a massive high of 65% on average to lows of, you know, less than 10% for most of the century. And that period is known as laissez-faire. And then classically, when you're splitting up the British Empire, you talk about the early empire, which, you know, the Elizabethans and the American colonies, and then the mercantilist period. So that's the early empire. Then you talk about the kind of middle period, the laissez-faire period. Some call it the period of indifference, where, you know, they presented themselves as this really interested in economics and interested in the spread of liberalism and things like that. And then in the late Victorian period, they become more actively imperialist and, start, you know, formally taking over places. And that is known as the period of quote unquote imperialism. Now we're going to be looking at different ways of thinking about this. But as you can see, the tariffs come down and then towards the end of the British Empire, right around 1930, after the Wall Street crash, you can see the tariffs massively go up. Okay. And surprisingly, the technical peak of the British Empire is not in the Victorian period. The Victorian period, you could call it the high noon, right? The high noon of the empire. But the peak in terms of total territories controlled around the world was in the 1930s. And you can see during that period, Britain became massively more protectionist. coming out, you know, in the interwar period. And the British Empire pretty much doesn't last more than 30 years after that point. It was succinctly summed up by Roy Douglas here in his book, Liquidation of Empire. This is the very first paragraph of that book where he says, "On the 10th of November 1942, Winston Churchill told the House of Commons, 'I have not become the King's First Minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire.' 5 years earlier, George Orwell, very much a man of the left, had reflected that at the bottom of his heart, no Englishman does want the empire to disintegrate. When Churchill spoke, children at school still celebrated Queen Victoria's birthday, the 24th of May, as Empire Day, when they were encouraged to reflect on the merits and durability of the British Empire, and received a half holiday in the afternoon to give the occasion a pleasant flavour. Many people who had profound qualms about the way in which the empire had been acquired, and even about the wisdom of acquiring an empire at all, would still have acknowledged that the speedy liquidation would do much damage not only to Britain, but to the remainder of the empire as well. And yet, by the time of Churchill's death in 1965, the British Empire had all but ceased to exist. Thanks, Churchill. You're a great one." So that is really the end there in the 60s. So what I want to focus on here is the relationship between free trade and empire, and how, if we could go back to my various graphs here, free trade, the period of free trade, represents an empire at the peak of its control, at the peak of its powers. Okay, very much so. In the upswing, you have the high tariffs, the mercantilist period. Then when it's dominant, when it's achieved a certain level of hegemony, you have laissez-faire as a control mechanism. And then when it's on the downward swing, as the, or in decline, as the British Empire clearly was from the 1930s onwards, then those tariffs start to sneak up. Now, just before I get to some of the other stuff I want to share, where there's some great material coming up on the British Empire, I want to show, I want to have a look again at this, the USA trajectory, because if you have a look on this graph here, during the period in which the British and the French were doing their laissez-faire, the USA was in its upward swing. It was a high protective tariffs in the 19th century, something Steve Bannon has talked about a lot, if you've ever listened to him. So that was when America was actually building its greatness, you know, coming up to the Gilded Age, and, you know, gold, like they had a period of prosperity coming out of the 19th century. Okay, so, and so they were well set to become a superpower in the 20th century due to almost a century of extremely high protective tariffs in the 19th century. Okay, and then you can see that US tariffs after World War II, when the USA becomes the hegemon, go, you know, that, and they bring in former colonial powers like France and Britain under their control and imposed, you know, quote unquote, free trade on them as well. You can see how they then enjoy a period of laissez-faire from about 1950 coming up to now, which is 2024. Okay, and if you have a look at the period of laissez-faire for Britain, it's about the same time as 1950 to now. And Trump obviously represents the end of that, which, if history is any guide, okay, means that the American empire should be looking at similar 1930, 1935, which means it's probably got another 20, 30 years before it truly ceases to be, you know, the hegemon. That is, using the British Empire as a guide. Now, one of the things I want to focus on for the remainder of this talk is This paper here, this paper, The Imperialism and Free Trade by John Gallagher and Ronald Robinson, was published in 1953. It's actually the most cited historical article ever written. I hadn't heard of it until today. It founded an entire school of historiography called the Cambridge School. John Gallagher was its foremost exponent, as was this Robinson. They both wrote a lot over the course of their careers, and they were experts in the history of the British Empire. Now, what they did in this paper is they turned conventional views or conventional histories of the British Empire on their heads by including not only the formal British Empire, that is, territories formally controlled by the British, but also the informal empire, which is territories that came under their economic zone or their economic spider's web, if you want to put it that way. And it's very useful to use this analysis to think about the British Empire, because the American Empire, of course, is not a proper empire, i.e. it has almost no formal areas under control. All of its empire is quote unquote informal, in the way that much of the British Empire was actually informal and not formal. Now, just before I get into the rest of this, I'll remind people, do buy Foundations of Shakespeare, great course available now, or the Trivium, Foundations of Writing, Foundations of Rhetoric and Logic, of course. Or given that we're talking about economics today, there is Foundations of Economics. I don't get into issues like imperialism on that. It's very much a mundane Econ 101 course. But if you'd like to know more about economics, pick that up as well. So I found an old video by a great channel. It's a guy called Frank H. Wallace, PhD. I'll put the link to this in the show notes. I thought this was so good that I was going to just kind of play it here. I don't want to interrupt him too much, but I'm going to pause it when I think that there's something, you know, worth interjecting or drawing out for my main thesis here. But let's listen to this. About an eight-minute video. So with interruptions from me, we're probably looking at another 12, 15 minutes here. All right, so this is Frank Wallace on imperialism.
Nowhere was the combination of nationalism and status more prevalent than in the case of the British Empire. Catherine Tidrick explained how the English ruling class believed that character would suffice to rule the empire, and that force was usually not necessary. The claim of the English aristocrats to leadership ordained by God was inextricably linked with hierarchy, duty, obedience, and religion, all pre-modern cultural traits. Men like Cecil Rhodes thought the English race was the best in the world and lesser peoples deserved to be ruled by them. But the British Empire was done on the cheap, hence the rationale for character over brute force. The tactic of indirect rule exalted the man on the spot, who could rule through charisma rather than by training, playing off local tribal leaders against each other. T.E. Lawrence believed he controlled Arabs without their knowing it. From the age of 8, English ruling class boys went off to public school like Eton, where they were denied family love, raised in savage brutality, and stimulated to confirm class attitudes that rich people had a right to rule everyone else. Britain never needed Adolf Hitler because these schools manufactured thousands of Führers.
I mean, I'm not sure about that final claim, but it is true that the public school system deliberately inculcated harsh conditions because they knew they were raising these young boys to be the elites, the rulers of this empire. So they needed to be tough, something that John Bagot Glubb talks about in his book, The Fate of Empires, which is highly relevant to this whole video as well. Let me let this guy continue. He's going through a number of different theories here We're really interested in the Cambridge School one, which he's going to get to. But these other ones are important as well. J.A. Hobson, if you remember when I did my video on Lenin and imperialism, Hobson was Lenin's chief source in that book, and talking about the British Empire. This was the classic study written in about 1904 of the British Empire in the early 20th century. So Hobson was kind of the standard for a long time until this Cambridge School came along. So let me let him continue.
Both the left and the right have highlighted the economic motive of imperialism. The classic liberal economist before 1914 thought capitalism needed to exploit foreign markets by force if necessary. Formal rule of colonies was not needed if free trade was allowed. The spread of civilization and trade was a white man's responsibility. J.A. Hobson thought a congeries of interests, military, missionaries, manufacturers, and bankers, formed in order to impose Western colonial subjugation on foreigners. But the taproot of imperialism was the influence of finance capitalists. The British upper class was hoarding wealth in the 19th century and needed a place to dump capital, colonies being the logical choice. But it starved the home country of investment, impoverishing the workers, a parasitic drain on the national treasury.
You can see there how Lenin builds his theory directly on top of that. And there is some truth to it, especially in terms of the direct investment, the capital going overseas, being exported, as Lenin talked about. But this is the one I really want to focus on here. Robinson and Gallagher, The Imperialism of Free Trade. Some stunning insights. I would definitely recommend reading the paper if you can get hold of it. So let me let Wallace take it away.
Robinson and Gallagher, in their Imperialism of Free Trade, suggested there was continuity in imperialism throughout the 19th century, but finance men played only a small role. In their view, imperialism was the direct political aspect of integrating new regions into the expanding British worldwide economy. Direct rule was necessary in regions where economic opportunity or strategic interest were great, but where security was minuscule. Indirect, informal control through free trade was the preferred method of imperialism. Both formal and informal empires were functions of the extending pattern of overseas trade, investment, migration, and culture. Informal rule, or outright political possession, depended in large part on the degree of collaboration available from the natives of any particular region. The process of expansion reached its most valuable targets long before the scramble for Africa in the last quarter of the 19th century. Imperialism was made possible only through the collaborative efforts of indigenous peoples, therefore more a function of African or Asian local politics than of European economic or geopolitical interests. When the imperial powers ran out of collaborators, they had to leave. So many African leaders petitioned Europe for help that it looked like a scramble for protection. In Africa and the Victorians, by Robinson and Gallagher, they buttressed theory with empirical evidence. British diplomats and merchants worked together to spread the rule of free trade from Buenos Aires to Istanbul, from the Niger to the Yangtze. Power was extended through cajolery, prestige, threats, or occasional bombardment. All regions were drawn into the empire of informal sway. The reason for British colonies in Africa was not for the sake of empire building, but for the strategic necessity of protecting sea routes to India. When security by informal influence broke down, the British moved in militarily. The trigger mechanism for such moves was nationalism. Nationalist rebellion in Egypt in 1882 prompted a British takeover and caused a scramble for colonies in Africa by the other great powers of Europe. In the days of Canning and Palmerston, The British had been able to exert imperial prestige through free trade without competition. What changed in the last quarter of the 19th century was British commercial and industrial supremacy was challenged by other powers in Europe like France and Germany.
I hope you can start to see now some parallels with the American Empire. Remember what this video is actually about. I mean, there are some really stunning and crucial insights from Wallace's summary of Robinson and Gallagher here. You know, the military, I mean, what he's saying is that the free trade is a great control mechanism because it means you don't need to expend military force. You don't need it most of the time. Now, if you think about America in the past decade or so, or two decades, really, from Bush Jr. to now, you know, it had a series of military escapades where they invaded Iraq, they invaded, Afghanistan. Recently, they toppled Assad in Syria. All of this is about bringing countries into its orbit, into its trade mechanism. This is really what the war in Ukraine has been about, because they want Ukraine to be part of its network. All of the expansions of the EU eastward into former, you know, all the things that upset Putin. And for most of the 20th century, for most of the post-war period, obviously there was the Cold War. From 1991 up until the emergence of Putin and now China as a major power, there was a period there where America basically had no rivals at all. It could just keep on going for it. Now, China and Russia are powerful enough to almost be like the Germans and the French and other rival powers that were in America, say, that are emerging in the late era of the British Empire, which meant that the British had to be more warlike, more imperialistic, more protectionist, etc., etc. So I hope you can see that America is actually following a very similar trajectory. And Trump, with his tariffs and his kind of more belligerent stances, actually starts to resemble late period British Empire. So anyway, let me get to the end of this video.
The British were forced to protect what they already owned by the method of imperial expansion. Their African empire was the product of fear, a fear of losing an early lead. If geography is important to empire building, then frontiers are critical to its definition. Empires require stable borders, and this results in a zone of chaos at the edge. Imperialists became obsessed with securing recently pacified frontiers, moving them forward incessantly. The tyranny of distance and the high cost of sustaining logistics and transport over wide areas leads to the axiom, power decays with distance. The British in 19th century Afghanistan come to mind as an example, protecting India by conquering more and more distant land. Still, there are
funny how Afghanistan keeps coming up in history, isn't it? It's a graveyard of every empire.
Those who insist British imperialism was about finance and not strategic interests. Kane and Hopkins, in their British Imperialism, thought the cause of imperialism was gentlemanly capitalism of aristocrats and London bankers. It was a metropolitan phenomena with 300 years of continuity from 1688 to the 21st century. The informal empire of free trade in British manufactures did not exist, and the periphery was a sideshow. The greatest expansion of London finance into the foreign market took place from 1850 to 1914, and after World War I had to compete on worsening terms with other centers of finance such as Japan, Germany, and the United States. Kane and Hopkins said imperialism was a collaborative process and required integration of world economics with that of Britain in an early example of globalization. But they also acknowledged that when the terms of credit from the city bankers involved loss of sovereignty to other nations, British expansion became imperialism. Theirs is a story of city bankers and loafing aristocrats pursuing the peaceful art of lending money. Yet, there is one area in which Kane and Hopkins and Robinson and Gallagher agree. They all stress the actions of economically motivated actors and do not rely on Marxian structure to explain imperialism.
All right. So, yeah, I thought that was
this
pretty interesting stuff. So anyway, I'll link that full video in the show notes. And I mean, it's possible. I mean, it's very difficult to estimate how long America will exist as, you know, as it does now, as a big hegemon, as, you know, all of us living under the remit of what is effectively the US empire. But this does look like at least the very beginning of the end, right? I mean, on that timeline, it could be like Britain in 1930, or we could be further along. We could be further along. It's very hard to say. But I do think the parallels are interesting. I also think the other thing that is interesting about this is that the whole doctrine of laissez-faire, libertarianism, classical liberalism, starts to make sense from a civilizational perspective, from a power perspective, from an elite theory perspective, if you see it as simply the economics of empire at high noon, right? The very fact that every empire from the Mongols to, you know, the Abbasids and so on, at a certain time when they expand big enough, you know, when their power is large enough and over a large enough area, you know, they tend to become liberal because the trade and the trade mechanism is itself a power mechanism. And this, to me, is makes sense because the political in elite theory always presupposes the economic. Okay, whereas liberalism tends to put that relationship the other way around. But of course, liberalism only makes sense if you're the hegemon. All right, that'll do for now. Let me know if there's a lot of stuff I covered here. Let me know if you have any questions, if you have any objections. I'm sure the libertarians among you will have lots of objections. And I will see you tomorrow. Oh, by Foundations of Shakespeare and Foundations of Economics and all the other great courses. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.